Hey, lab rats. It's Kendra.
And this is Jessica.
And you're listening to
Lucid Lab. Yay for lab reports.
And we're on lucky number 7 today.
Mm-hmm. That's my number.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Always has been since I was a little girl. I've 7 on everything.
I don't really have a number. Never really thought about it.
If I were to pay attention to the numbers that I see the most now, it probably wouldn't be my number. But ever since I was a little girl, like all my tags, all my emails, there's always 7s everywhere. I see 44 more than anything else, or 444.
Yeah.
I see that number or a combination of it more than anything else, like multiple times a day, have for years and years. So that's definitely my go-to number now.
Yeah.
When I see a 7, I'm like, oh, cute.
Well, did you make it through spring break?
Having a kid home on spring break when you have to work the entire time anyway is difficult, but I tried to take her out. We went out to eat a couple times. We went to the library, which is really interesting. I've never taken her to a public library, so it was an experience. So we spent like 3 hours there because she was just so amazed.
Libraries are pretty cool. My kids love them. Even still, like when we traveled to New England last year, we went to several libraries while we were there.
There's never been one close. Mm-hmm. Like they built one out here and it's really nice. She rented out like 10 books. She hasn't even started reading any of them. So they're just sitting there, but at least it's for 3 weeks. I just have to remember to take them back. But what was really cool is she's never seen The Neverending Story and they had it there.
Oh.
So I rented the movie. She knows the song from part of Stranger Things. I don't let her watch all the Stranger Things.
Yeah.
She really likes that kind of stuff. And she heard The Neverending Story song. I don't know if
it's very catchy.
Yeah.
Oh no, that was one of my favorite movies growing up.
So now she's obsessed with singing the song. And now I regret what we chose for her to do in the talent show, because she's in her talent show and she's singing a song and she won't even practice it because all she's doing is running around singing that song all the
time. Can you switch?
No, but it's hard that she won't practice it because it does require practice. She knows the words and everything, but the particular song she chose, the singer sings it super low and she's not a low singer. So her brain tries to sing it low and then she like figures out her tune along the way and
It's not working. Yeah.
But if she starts at where her voice is natural, then it sounds great. But her brain plays a trick on her.
Yeah, because she wants to replicate what she's heard.
Yeah. And it's hard as well because she's second to last. Like they gave us the list.
Okay.
And this is out of 52 acts. And I'm like, you're going to leave a lasting impression, honey. You're the last one singing.
And you have to wait that long. Like, and I get nervous. If I'm in something like that, I want to be the first one so I can get it over with. Like sitting there anticipating is
tough. It won't even be on her mind. It just goes over her head.
She's just going to be watching everybody else.
Well, she likes being on stage.
Oh, that's right. We've talked about that. She's a little Leo.
Yeah, she's definitely Leo. But lately she's pretending she's nervous, or she's actually becoming nervous. I don't know, one of the two. Because when she auditioned, she wouldn't look at them. And I'm like, what are you doing?
Well, she may be getting to that age where she's more self-conscious.
Mm-hmm.
It sucks when you lose that ability as a child to just not care what people think.
No, she's always been just amazing on stage. Like she could do anything. But yeah, we'll see what happens. She doesn't seem bothered by it. She doesn't even want to practice. So.
She's like, I'll be fine.
Jeez, stop making a big deal out of it. We did some other stuff, just got her out. We went and saw a movie and I got us a bowling pass so we can kind of go bowling, go play a couple games every day if we wanted to, which
That'd
is nice just to have the option. I got myself out on a walk last night like a crazy person. We've had really good weather, but last night was not windy and like 30 degrees. And I'm like, this is the perfect time to go walking
at
11 o'clock at night. So I was freezing when I came back. Couldn't really hear anything. And there were kind of some cars that slowed down a little bit too much while I was walking. So that kind of made me nervous because I don't usually deal with that. But I'm not in my usual nature preserve where I walk. So that was an interesting choice for me. But I did it. And now I'm a little snotty today because it made my nose go crazy.
Well, the pollen's rushing around right now in the wind.
Yeah, and I just inhaled it all. So,
well, I've done nothing much this week except for be ruled by my new kitten.
I
talked about my cat, I don't know, a couple of episodes ago. So we did get the cat and he's home now and he's adorably cute and very cuddly, but he's also super playful because he's 6 months old. We named him Fritz.
Yeah,
which
that's
a great
name.
It fits his little personality. I'm teaching a kitten. It's like being a new mom. He's up every couple of hours at night wanting to play. So I figured out last night that he's going to have have his own room so that I can get some sleep.
Mm-hmm.
He'll eventually come cuddle and sleep with me, but right now he's just too rambunctious. So
he's literally climbing up on her bed and using her body as a trampoline. He goes on top of her headboard and goes whoop-poo.
He totally does. And he like lands right on my chest and it like scares the shit out of me. Like, and then he also thinks that my feet and hands are playthings. Mm-hmm. So he keeps jumping on those. Anyone who has had a kitten knows how this is. I haven't had a kitten, I guess, ever. The last time I had one was when I was 8 years old and I obviously wasn't taking care of him. Yeah. So it's a new experience. I don't regret it. He's adorable. And maybe I'll post a picture on Instagram.
You should.
With that, let's go ahead and start on our fun lab reports episodes today.
We're going to keep it similar to last time only because if you've been listening to episodes, I did a two-parter and then I had to edit that immediately. So I didn't really have time. So she went ahead and did the research for the two mini episodes and I'm sticking to our listener stories, but we're going to half it up.
Yeah, next
moving
time.
Forward.
We're still, you know, working it all out.
We hope you enjoy these.
We did get some good feedback on the new format. We're going to keep going with it.
Yep, I think it's good. So I'm going to start with the first lab reports, and this is a butterfly effect story, our first that we're going to read. So I was excited to see one of those come through. We'd like to see more of those.
Yeah, I like hearing
these. We actually
didn't
get very many of those. Maybe the butterfly effect episode was boring. I don't know.
I don't think so. It was well listened to.
That's true. It does get good listens. So send some more, please. All right, here we go. What's up, ladies? I'm Steph, and I would love to tell you my butterfly effect story. Of course, my story is full of tons of little butterfly effect moments, but there is one big moment that changed the course of my life, like a complete 180. It took years for me to attribute it all back to this, but I am so very thankful for it, even though the decision that led me down this path was relatively simple. 19 years ago, I was 15 years old. It was a Saturday. I woke up around 11 a.m., which was typical of me on the weekends. I had some breakfast and hung out in my room listening to music for a while. I didn't have a lot of friends, but I had a small knit group of three friends, and I knew at some point one of them would call and we would end up doing something. One of us had a car, so if it meant actually going somewhere, that friend would have to be involved. And that was my friend Kelsey. We never planned things ahead of time. It was just expected that we would be together on Saturdays at some point. For the most part, it would be all four of us almost every time. However, around that time, Kelsey had a new boyfriend.
That always takes away friend time.
So we were seeing less of her, which made life less interesting for us because she was our ride.
Okay, she's the car
owner. She's the car.
That's a problem.
That Saturday, I finally got the call around 2 p.m. It was my true best friend, Lene. I have known Lene longer than anyone. We met in daycare. So I guess you could say the first butterfly effect would have been my mom choosing that daycare so that I could meet Lene. So many moments throughout my life, but that's a big one. Lene and I were so close that my mom signed me up for her elementary school. I wasn't in the same district, but we wanted to be together.
That's nice.
That's sweet of
and
the
that
moms
they accepted
to do
you.
That.
Yeah, you never know.
As we always do, we chatted for a few minutes before one of us asked, what are we going to do? If we couldn't go somewhere like the mall, park, or movies, we all preferred to hang out at Addie's house. Her parents were rich, like rich, rich. She had a pool, hot tub, theater room, game room with a pool table, arcade games, an art room, and snacks galore, you name it. And her parents weren't checking in on us, like ever, so it was the place
nice.
To be. We loved it there. But Addie didn't always want to be home, so we did try to go somewhere if we could. This particular Saturday, Kelsey was with her boyfriend and Addie didn't want to be home, so we decided to meet at my house. They both rode their bikes over. We made some pizza and watched a little bit of MTV. Well, this is kind of...
It's got to be back in our generation.
Yeah, it's timing MTV. Her a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We decided to ride our bikes to the mall. That wasn't the coolest thing to do, but we were kind of desperate. It wasn't an easy ride. There were parts of the ride where we would have to get off and walk the bikes because of the incline. That also meant we would have to ride them back, which we weren't looking forward to, but we did it anyway. We made it to the mall, locked up our bikes, and went inside. We went to the bathroom first to freshen up, which, looking back, was so silly of us because we despised everyone and gave all the boys dirty looks.
But you still want to look good while doing it.
Yeah. Although I know we all secretly wanted not just any boy, but the boy to notice us.
Of course.
After that, we stopped by the candy shop, the kind where they sell candy by the pound. Maybe it was just me, but I couldn't go to the mall without getting a bag of goodies to walk around with.
This is so taking me back to when I was in high school and junior high, because that was the first stop. I always got the big, long sour string.
Those are my favorite things from the candy shop.
Yes.
My favorite things.
Every time I went to the mall.
Yep. I love doing that to go to a movie with.
Yes.
you'd go and get the candy and then go to the movie with that. Because then you had all these different options to eat while you were watching the movie. We walked around for a while just goofing off. We always stopped into Spencer's and Hot Topic, the best mall shops ever. After a while, we decided to watch a movie. The theater was part of the mall. We bought tickets for Monster in Law. Do you remember that movie?
Was that?
It's Jennifer Lopez
and Jane Fonda, right?
Yeah, Jane Fonda. Yeah. I think I own that. I think it's out in my living room right now. Okay, so they bought tickets for Monster in Law, but we snuck out 20 minutes in to go watch House of Wax. Oh,
smart.
Horror over Jennifer Lopez any day.
But yes.
We did that often. We didn't have time to convince our parents to come to buy tickets for us. Once the movie was over, we grabbed some pizza in the food court. Pizza twice in one day. Sounds good right now.
It sounds like a normal pizza. Child.
That was last weekend for us.
I actually just had pizza for breakfast because we had leftovers. And I had I love cheese pizza for breakfast.
Mm. I didn't eat before you came. Now I'm really hungry.
Oh, sorry.
Dang it. And my stomach was growling right when we started recording. I'm like, I wonder if that's going to show up in the audio.
Hopefully you get pizza later today.
Okay, pizza in the food court. It wasn't as exciting a night as we'd hoped, and we were ready to go. But we had a problem. Leaving the theater, Addie was being ridiculous and tried jumping over a pole and hurt her ankle. Walking home would take us forever, so she called her dad to come get us. He had a huge truck, thankfully, that could fit all of our bikes in the back. So we went outside to get our bikes and wait. It was a nice night. It was going to take him 20 to 30 minutes. As we were waiting, a group of boys came up to us, older boys. Not by much, but I could tell that some of them were closer to 20. As I mentioned, we gave boys dirty looks. So we weren't in the mood to entertain their advances. They were all talking at the same time too, which was really annoying. Real sweet talkers. They weren't our type. All black clothes, low pants, chains, the works. One boy in particular grabbed my attention though, because he was quiet and had a face tattoo.
Oh.
I remember being really interested in him. Something about those quiet ones. Those are the scary ones.
Yeah. Sometimes. What are they thinking?
I've learned that over a very long period of time. So I got a really good look at him. His tattoo was a small dragon. It started on his forehead above his eyebrow and curled down under his eye. He was cute. His hair was slicked back. It was his smile too. Honestly, he was gorgeous. Addie was the talker of the group though, and boy, did she have that attitude down. She managed to make them walk away. I was a little sad at first, but little did I know she probably saved my life then and there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I was eating dinner with my mom and she had the news on. A 17-year-old boy was gunned down in front of a convenience store the night before and the suspect has yet to be found. They knew who the murderer was and showed his picture, asking for any help in identifying his whereabouts. The picture came on the TV and I had to do a double take. He looked familiar. I couldn't put my finger on it until the news person said, "What we do know is that he now has a dragon tattoo on his face around one eye."
Oh, wow.
So it must have been an old picture.
Mm-hmm.
My jaw dropped. It was the cute, mysterious thug from the night before. He was a murderer. I couldn't believe it. I immediately called my friends. I told my mom as well, and she told me that I needed to call the police. Seeing him might not mean anything, but maybe it would help them piece together the night. So I did, and they asked me to come in for an official statement. Part of me felt guilty, like I was turning in my make-believe boyfriend. I had to keep reminding myself, he killed someone.
Mm-hmm.
But why? Was it gang-related? Was it one of the guys that was with him talking to us? Who was it? My mom drove me to the station. While we were waiting, my mom got a work call and had to step outside. Sitting two seats away, there was another teenager, a boy. We sat in silence for a bit, but he spoke up and complimented my shoes. What I haven't mentioned is that I was a wannabe artist. Since middle school, I have been drawing on my shoes. Still do. Then my shoes were entirely covered with my artwork. That particular pair had tons of doodles on them, but he was specifically complimenting my cartoon ring-tailed lemur.
Aww.
For as long as I can remember, I've been obsessed with all kinds of monkeys, and I love the lemur's long decorative tails.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't in trouble or anything. I guess his aunt was a policewoman, and he was with her, and she had to stop at work for something, so he was just waiting. He started talking to me about a trip he took to Madagascar with his family a couple years before and how much he loved it. There wasn't much else to our conversation before my mother came back in. A couple of weeks later, the cartoon movie Madagascar came out. I still look back and just giggle about that. What's the likelihood? But that seared Madagascar into my brain. Fast forward to the fall of 2008, I started at Northwestern. Where's Northwestern?
I should know that, but I don't.
Hold, looking up.
I have a feeling it might be in the Northwest.
Okay, that would make sense.
And we would be wrong. It's in Illinois.
I guess so.
I guess that's northwest of the East Coast.
Right? Okay. Illinois. I majored in art theory and practice with an adjunct major in African studies, and I minored in French.
He's getting busy. Yeah, those are a lot of different things.
In 2010, I made my wish a reality and took a trip to Madagascar with a friend from school. She was an anthropology major with a minor in French. So this trip was made for us. It was an amazing trip. On our flight back, I had an aisle seat, which I despised, but I agreed to it because it was better than being in the middle, and that's where she was.
Yeah.
She was able to sleep amazingly, which I wasn't. In the row across from me, there was a guy, a delicious man. I caught myself turning to look at him way too often for the first few hours. He had his nose in a book, and I was thankful for that at first because I knew I was being too obvious.
Mm-hmm.
He got up to use the restroom, and when he came back, he sat down and his book fell down by my feet. I picked it up and handed it to him, and our eyes locked, and they still do today. We spent the rest of the flight talking. He was from Canada, but was living in Chicago at the time. He was in Madagascar for leisure like me. He met up with a couple friends there. And as the story goes, we hit it off. We commuted back and forth to see each other while I finished my undergrad degree and moved in with each other right after that. We married a year later, and we now have three beautiful, wildly smart, creative children. He is my soulmate. We live in Quebec. Quebec, however you say it. So what was the butterfly effect moment that I attribute my life to? Well, any one of the things that happened could be it.
Yeah.
But it was my decision to go to the police station because I was really conflicted about it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ask me why. I was a kid. Part of me was scared that that cute murderer would come after me someday. And I wasn't sure if I would kiss him or scream. But if I didn't go, I wouldn't have had that short conversation with that boy, and Madagascar wouldn't have become the number one place I wanted to go, all because I drew a lemur on my shoe. And honestly, I don't even know if I would have majored in what I did if it wasn't for that conversation. I think about that often because my interests were gradual over years. They weren't one moment decisions.
Right.
I ended up taking French in high school and wanted to continue with that, and I was really good at it. I was still a major art nerd, but majoring in African studies was a bit random. But if it wasn't for that and my experience leading up to it and meeting someone who wanted to go with me, I wouldn't have gone to Madagascar then, and I wouldn't have met the love of my life on the way back.
Wow.
So absolutely every little decision can change the trajectory of your life. I have no idea where I would be now if it wasn't for my odd monkey obsession. Stay lucid, girls. Your fan from Canada. Love, Steph.
Wow, that was really cool, like how it all came together.
Yeah.
And I think all of us, when we think about our lives, as we discussed in your episode, have those moments and
all over the place.
And we're going to continue to have those. I don't know what I'm doing today that could lead to who knows what next.
And it takes a couple years to look back and be like, oh, that one little decision led me to right now.
It's
crazy.
There's so many of them. All of us should think of them. I think everyone could write a butterfly effect story about their lives.
Every single person could write 100.
Yes.
Really?
True. But thank you for sharing. What was her name again?
Steph. Yes. Thank you, Steph. That was awesome.
And
I love that.
You're Canadian. We haven't heard from a Canadian on the show yet.
Well, it sounds like she's from here.
Oh, she lives in Quebec.
Lives in Canada. Yeah.
I haven't been there. It's on my list one day.
I haven't either.
Someday.
I mean, we could drive there if we wanted to. Alrighty. What's next?
So I am going to move us into a mini episode, and apparently I'm on a roll here with haunted places because this is one that was also recommended by one of our listeners.
What is it?
So the title of this is Lake Shawnee Amusement Park.
I've heard about Lake Shawnee.
Have you?
Yeah. I've either heard some episodes on it or I've seen something on TV. But yeah, that sticks out.
I had not heard of this, and which is kind of surprising because it's in West Virginia, and I actually, my kids' grandparents live in West Virginia, and I never heard of this place, but it's in a completely different part of the state than where we would travel to.
Interesting. And you know what I just realized? I never remember that West Virginia is a state.
Yeah.
Like, I never talked to anybody who ever mentions it.
It's a very small state.
When I hear it, I'm like, oh, yeah, that thing exists.
I have traveled to West Virginia quite often, and my kids go there still in the summertime. It is absolutely beautiful.
I imagine.
Yeah. It is all green. I think their state motto is wild and wonderful, which really fits. Mm. So if you like the outdoors, it's a great place. A lot of people know of it as being very poor coal mining country, which it is in parts of the state, but a lot of it is just nature. It's really, really pretty.
I want to go.
There are actually many sites in the state of West Virginia that would pique interest for potentially larger episodes that you and I can do.
Okay.
The most famous probably is the Mothman.
I almost did that.
Yeah.
A long time ago. I don't know why I turned away from it. So it'll still come.
I would love to see you do that one. It has always fascinated me. It's in Point Pleasant, which isn't that far from where my ex-in-laws live.
Oh, okay.
And I think my kids have visited there.
Interesting. So. Well, maybe it's coming up.
Yes.
But yeah, I almost did that. And it was like my focus for like 3 days. And for some reason, I turned away from it. I don't remember why.
We got to do some cryptids.
I will revisit.
I know. I had Bigfoot on my list and same thing. There's also the haunted prison in Moundsville, West Virginia, and then the infamous insane asylum in Winston, Ooh. West Virginia. So those are three that you might hear from us in the future. But mm-hmm. today we're doing Shawnee Lake Amusement Park because I didn't think it was quite large enough to do a full episode on.
Yeah.
And it was recommended to us by a listener. So thank you for that. Let's talk about it.
Cool. And I think I know part of this, so I won't give it away.
Okay. Lake Shawnee Amusement Park is an abandoned amusement park that is located in Mercer County, West Virginia, and it's attracted fans for years now. Ghost hunters have gone there. Curious road trippers will stop by. Dozens of TV shows have filmed segments on the grounds, and thousands of guests continue to stop by every single year. Visitors have claimed to hear footsteps, mysterious chants, and the sounds of children while visiting the park. More stories to come in a minute, but as we always do here on Lucid Lab, we can't talk about all the creepy happenings until we have explored some of the history about this place.
Yes, and there is some history with this one.
Yes, and as we have found in many American haunted locales we have visited so far on the show, they tend to start with some not so nice history involving the mistreatment of the Native Americans, and this one will be no different.
Yeah.
The violent history of Lake Shawnee Amusement Park started way back in the 18th century, hundreds of years before this would become a destination for families in 1926. So in April of 1774, a man by the name of Mitchell Clay obtained a crown grant from Lord Dunmore, who was the royal governor of Virginia, and he was given 803 acres of land, which covered both sides of the Bluestone River, which was a tributary of the New River, and it was called Clover Bottom, West Virginia. Now, the New River area had already been settled quite a bit. It was like everybody was coming to this area right along that river and settling. But this particular tract of land was kind of away from all the other settlers. So they were pretty isolated.
Okay.
Within the next year, after he was awarded this 800 acres, he, his wife, and 14 children, she was busy. She was pregnant all the time, like Rose West.
Right.
They moved onto the land and started cultivating it and living off of it, making it a working farm with cattle and all the things that you do. It was their homestead and the first white settlement within Mercer County.
Okay. And going back to the 14 children, you also have to remember that they lost children back then. So how many pregnancies really? That's 14 living
kids. You're right. But I guess if you're going to be a farmer, you are creating your own workforce.
Yeah, I get it.
So the Clay family made for themselves a prosperous farm. It contained a field for livestock. They had a tobacco field, wheat field. They had an orchard, and they had a kitchen garden as well to feed the family. And then they built their own home there. So it was a nice little property of land.
Yeah.
But although this area was being offered up by the American government for settlers to stake their claim, this land had been part of the Shawnee tribe for a long, long time before. Yeah. And they were not happy at people just taking it and calling it their own.
No.
As anyone would be upset if somebody just showed up at my house and was like, I'm going to take this today, I would be pissed.
Like the Israelites.
Yeah.
We don't talk about it much, but.
When will we stop doing this shit? The government, Lord Dunmore, whoever the fuck he was, felt like this area was open for settling because the Shawnee tribe, they weren't living directly on this 800 acres. So why not? But what you don't realize is just because the tribe's not living there, they may have been using it for other things, which we'll find out later. This land was sacred to them. And we had the audacity to just come in there and be like, well, they're not, you know, actively living on it. So we'll take it.
Well, everybody does it.
Yeah. And they were. And this was a big mistake, unfortunately, that would affect the Clay family and their children.
Yeah.
So in August of 1783, you can kind of see where this is going. The New River developments are happening. The Shawnee tribe is watching it and they're not happy. And so there have been like raids up and down the area.
Yeah.
And it would come, unfortunately, to this land in August of 1783. So Mitchell Clay had harvested one of his first crops of small grain and he wanted to store it away from the pasture field so the cows couldn't get into it. And he had asked his two sons, Bartley and Ezekiel. I believe Ezekiel was around like 16 and Bartley was somewhere between 12 and 14 years old.
Bartley.
Bartley.
Interesting. Is that what Bart Simpson's name is short for?
Could be. I never thought about that. Bartley. Yeah, that's a different one.
Huh.
So they were going to be working on building a fence around this grain to keep the cattle out. And then Mitchell was setting off for the day to go hunting. So the kids and the wife were at home alone. Their oldest daughter, her name was Tabitha. She and her younger sisters were down on the riverbank nearby working on the family washing for the day. So just a normal day.
Yeah.
It was known in this area when I was looking up the research that the Native American, the Shawnee tribe, they would send out groups of warriors, and they would unfortunately watch and wait for the men to leave the house. Aww. And they were attacking the women and children. I'm not saying that they should have been doing that just because we took the land. These people were not their enemies, but this kind of stuff was happening.
Yeah.
So while the children were all out working between the fences and the wash, a group of Shawnee crept up to the edge of the field, and they were just kind of watching what was going on, and they saw their chance to attack. There were about 11 of them in the group, and they pulled out a gun and they aimed it and they shot Bartley.
Oh,
and he fell right away. The girls heard the shot fired, and they knew, I guess everyone in the area probably knew some of the stuff was going on. So they immediately were like dropping everything they did, and they began running towards the house, towards safety. But unfortunately, running towards the house put them directly in the path of where Bartley and Ezekiel had been. And at that point, the Shawnee warriors had already started running towards the body. Now, Tabitha being the oldest, I think she kind of was maybe protecting her sisters, or she was genuinely worried about her brothers. It didn't say what her age was. I don't know if she was older, but she instinctively ran towards her brother, Bartley, who was now lying on the ground, probably to see if she could help him.
Yeah.
What was going on?
She didn't know if he was dead or not.
Yes. And unfortunately, that motherly instinct of hers put her directly into danger. And one of the men easily overtook her. They said she put up a fight. She tried to secure the knife from his belt, but she was ultimately overpowered and he killed her with that knife.
Oh, no.
It was said that the Shawnee then scalped both Bartley and Tabitha.
Yeah.
Now, Ezekiel was still there, and for whatever reason, they did not kill him at this time, but instead they chose to capture him. And so they left the two children that they had killed, and they threw Ezekiel on the horse with them and rode off.
He's a hostage.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's part of their strategy, right? Is to take hostages and try and
make
negotiate.
Them leave.
Mm-hmm. The really sad part is Phoebe, who was Mitchell's wife and the matriarch of the family, was inside the house watching this all happen.
Oh.
And she was helpless to do anything. She had all her younger children in the house, and she's watching her other older children out being attacked.
And scalped.
During this fight, there was actually a man who had just shown up at her house, and his name was Ligon Blankenship. And he had stopped by, Ligon, he had stopped by just happenstance for some reason. And this stuff started going down while he was at the house. And Mrs. Clay begged him to get involved. She said, "You have to go out there, take my husband's gun. You have to save the children." Instead of helping, he basically ran away.
Mm.
He was like, "Peace, I'm sorry for your troubles, but I'm getting out of here." He didn't want to get involved. And his name, the Blankenship name, has still tarnished, I think, in this area. And they're known as cowards.
Like a coward. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But also, he's sitting there watching 11
of
Native
them
American,
and they're
like,
scalping.
I don't
That's
know.
Like offering yourself up for the slaughter, really.
Like, unless he was an amazing shot and could, like, and they didn't have automatic rifles back then. So I can't really fault the guy. What was he supposed to do? And he would have drawn
That's
attention that there were more people in the house.
That's very
come.
True.
So
yeah,
I just threw that in there, that the poor Blankenship name and Ligon is still like disgraced to this day. He did run back to the nearest settlements in New River and reported to the people there that the Clay family had been attacked. So
maybe he
went back to try and find help, but by then the men were gone.
Yeah.
And at that time, Phoebe ran out when she knew they were gone, and she did recover the bodies of her two children.
Mm.
She brought them into the house and laid them on the bed. She was in this helpless situation, and she had other children to protect. And so she rounded up her other children, and she actually walked 6 miles away to their nearest neighbor, which was James Bailey, which I feel like was a pretty scary thing to do.
Yeah, that's
because you don't know
pretty
where those
crazy.
Men went. They could have attacked them while they were walking, but fortunately, they made it. So she's gone. And then Mitchell Clay comes home from hunting to the scene.
Yeah.
He walks into the house. Everybody's gone. And two of his children are laying in the bed dead.
Yeah.
And his first assumption is that his family must have been captured. The rest of them must have been carried off by the Native American tribe.
Nobody writes notes back then?
She didn't. I guess. Because she was, who knows what state she was in. She's okay. Like, gotta go. Maybe she thought her husband had been killed by the men already.
That's
too.
That's true.
So she was in fight or flight mode. Mm-hmm. She wasn't writing. Or maybe she didn't have a pen.
Maybe she didn't know how to write.
Possible.
She could have drawn in the sand. Arrow. Like a big arrow.
And gone.
12 children. Little pictures of children.
Mitchell, of course, is freaked out and he travels to the New River settlements, and he was reunited with his family at that point. So he knew all of them were safe, but they knew at this point that Ezekiel had been captured. So they put this posse together to go off and find them and to seek revenge because they didn't want the Shawnee to keep coming back and murdering their people. So apparently after leaving the Clay property, the Shawnee group broke off into two, and the ones that had Ezekiel with them went back towards their main hub.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other group kind of was staying in the area, and the other group is what they found when the posse went out looking for them.
Okay.
And a fight ensued, and two of the Shawnee were killed immediately and several others were wounded. They realized that Ezekiel was not with this group, and the little brother of Ezekiel, his name was Charles Clay. He was only 12 years old at the time. He managed to capture one of the Shawnee, and when he found out that his brother wasn't there, he was like full of rage, and he ended up like killing this man like close up at age 12. Like different kind of times back then.
Yeah,
but he was just so frustrated. And
I mean, they killed
two of
brother
his,
and sister.
Yeah, and his other brother's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know where he is. There is a story about this, which I think is kind of bizarre and also lends to why there might be some unrest on this land. Two of the men were, in a way, like just as crazy. You know, the Native Americans would scalp people. That was known to be part of their traditions. But these two white men from two of the dead men, they actually took strips of their back.
Oh.
And they like dried them out and they kept them. This sounds like some kind of Buffalo Bill bullshit here. And they dried them out and they turned them into razor straps, which I had to look this up, but it's apparently what you use to sharpen your razor.
Oh.
And they kept this in their family possession for generations after generations. And it was passed down. And to me, that's just gross.
Yeah.
I get it. You wanted revenge, but to keep a piece of a human being.
Yeah.
Pretty fucked up.
That is a curse.
And that was right not there. The Clay family. Yeah. This was just two other dudes that were in the posse that apparently liked killing. Mm. Their names were Edward Hale and William Wiley. So those two families have some generational trauma because they're passing along pieces of human.
Yeah.
Mm. So as I said, the groups had split up and the other group got all the way back to Chillicothe, Ohio, which was where their main hub was. And they had their prisoner, Ezekiel Clay. And unfortunately, they tortured him there and then they burned him at the stake.
Whoa, he's just a kid.
I know.
What
and
the fuck?
I don't know what they were trying to do. Maybe they would have tried to negotiate, but then when the posse went after and killed more of their tribe members.
That's true.
It was just a fucked up time back then. I'm glad I'm not a settler.
Seriously.
Or a Native American at the time.
I just don't want to live back then.
Surprisingly, the chief of the Shawnee, they still had some, I guess, traditions, decency, whatever you want to call it. They did return the body of Ezekiel to his family. Like they met up. Mm-hmm. They had a peace treaty and they handed over the body of Ezekiel.
Burned.
Yes.
Okay.
Whatever was left of him.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I didn't even think about that. I guess it was his bones. But they were able to then bury their three children. And their three children are still buried on this land today where the amusement park would eventually be in Mercer County.
Okay.
And there is a marker there for the three children of the Clay family. After this brutal attack on their homestead, Phoebe, the mom, refused to return to the Clay farm. And she insisted that she was moving somewhere else. And she moved to Parisburg to be near her oldest daughter, Rebecca. And she never stepped foot on that property again for the rest of her life.
Well,
don't blame her. But I guess all the other people went back.
Oh.
So I don't know if they just didn't have a mom.
Ego?
I guess they had their farm or whatever.
Yeah.
This has been known as the Clover Bottom Massacre. If you look it up, it's also the Clay Family Massacre. And there is a historical marker in the area if you drive through.
Oh, okay.
I don't really like how the historical marker is
just for them.
Yeah. And the way that it states it, they are just like, so-and-so was killed by Indians here.
Oh.
I think we probably need to change that. Anyways.
There's a lot of things that need to change. We talked about this in the last lab reports.
Yeah. I looked at the historical marker and I was like, that's probably not the whole story.
Yeah.
Like, anyways. Yes, they were probably unprovoked. The family had no part of like that, but
right.
They also should have known 800 acres given to you.
Oh, here's 803 acres. Oh, great. There's nothing that comes along with that that would be bad.
So this is the bloody beginnings to the land that eventually would be purchased to build a family park approximately 140 years later.
Sounds great.
There's some land that just needs to be left alone.
Yes.
You know, we talked about Atchison, Kansas. There's probably some shit like this that happened there too. And that's why it's plagued by demons.
Yeah.
So flash forward that 140 years. And now we are with an entrepreneur named Conley Snydow.
You know why I like hearing these old stories? Because weird.
Because the names.
Yeah.
His middle name is Trigg. Conley Trigg Snydow.
Where'd they all go? Why are we so boring now?
Now we all just use the same names over and
Sarah.
Over.
Sarah. Just kidding.
These are more fun.
But it's because everybody was coming over from other countries.
That's true.
Settling here. So
we were the melting pot.
Melting pot. I want to go eat right now.
You're so hungry. That's all you can think about. So Snydow purchased the land and he began developing an amusement park for the people of Mercer County, West Virginia. His vision was to build a place for local families to relax and enjoy time together because he realized the coal miners from local towns, they didn't have a lot of places to go.
Yeah, they had nothing to do.
It became a summer destination. It did very well. The park was packed every day pretty much when it was warm weather out. They had several activities. It featured a man-made swimming lake. It had a racetrack. There were concessions, there were cabins for visitors to stay overnight. And then they had the whole amusement park area with Ferris wheel and the swings, which were like the old timey, they were wooden swings that went around and around just like today at our amusement parks and carnivals.
Right.
And those were the two big rides that everybody went to. Unfortunately, tragedy would begin to grip the Lake Shawnee Amusement Park in the 1950s when several deaths occurred. So it had been going well for, I guess, like 25 something years. And then things started to go south.
It makes you wonder if they disturbed something.
It does make you wonder,
like,
because why was everything okay?
Yeah, like something got moved or something. They were trying to expand into one spot and it like dug into a specific grave or something.
Might be. In the 1950s, three deaths occurred of children at the park. One was a little boy who was drowned in the swimming pool. His arm became stuck in a drain pipe.
That is so scary. Did you hear about the little 7-year-old girl that died recently in the hotel pool because she got sucked into
one of the filter things?
Uh-huh.
Oh my God.
And they couldn't get her out. They tried for 20 hours.
That's horrible.
I hope she went fast. Sorry to bring it down, but swimming pools are scary. Just don't let your kids go in and just leave them there.
The one that I am the most afraid of are the wave pools.
Oh yeah.
Have you heard? There's been so many deaths in wave pools.
Handle that when I was in it. Like I was scared.
I remember going in as a teenager and same thing. I was like, nope, I want out. Yeah, I would never let my kids go
in. Only people who are safe in wave pools are the people on the tubes. And what you're doing is you're just covering the people underneath you, though. Mm-hmm. It's so dangerous. You're knocking everybody down. You're on top of them.
And there's too many people around. The lifeguards can't watch. Which leads into the next story. There was another child who drowned in the swimming lake and he was out there with his whole family, all of his siblings, and nobody noticed. He just slipped under. Aww. Remember, drowning deaths are very silent. It's
they
not
are.
Like you see in the movies with people flapping their arms. They just go under and can't get back up. So we had two drownings and then a really brutal one. There was a young girl and she was on the swing ride and it was just going around and you know how fast the swings go. And somehow there was a delivery truck coming in at the same time.
Oh.
And I guess he was a new driver. I don't know how this happened, but the truck was backing up and backed into the seat while it was going.
Oh my God.
On the swing.
How does it get that close?
I don't know how this happened, but a little girl was in one of the swings and basically you can just
smashed
see how it happened.
It.
She just blunt force trauma right into the side of a truck.
Whoa.
They started doing lots of health inspections when these happened. And by 1967, the Lake Shawnee Amusement Park was closed because of failing health inspection. Every amusement park out there probably has accidents and deaths. I know.
Tons. Yeah. I bet you.
Yeah. The one I went to growing up in Dallas, Texas had a death on one of my favorite rides.
Ugh.
But it was a woman who should not have been allowed to ride the ride.
Was she drunk?
No, she was too heavy.
Oh.
And the safety mechanisms are only rated for a certain weight.
Oh.
And she came out.
Oh, no.
And it's really fucking sad.
Yeah.
But there's
scary.
A reason that they put those regulations in place.
Yeah.
So it shut down in 1967. Nothing really happened for a while. It just sat vacant and looked kind of creepy because nothing was torn down. So you just had a defunct looking swing set and Ferris wheel.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 1980s, there was a man by the name of Gaylord White, and he had been a former employee in the glory days of Lake Shawnee, and he wanted to restore it to its splendor.
Oh, okay.
And in addition to purchasing a new Ferris wheel, he found a swing ride that seemed to be just like the swings that once thrilled the guests back in the 1920s. He found them through like an antique
kind of auction. Yeah, they're antique for a reason. Don't let them swing again.
Here's the crazy part. They installed the swings on the property, and then he did some research because there were serial numbers on these swings, and they found out that they were actually the original swings.
Oh my goodness.
One of them being where the little girl
died,
had been riding.
Yeah.
I feel like that's
an a sign.
Omen.
Yeah. They found their way back. That's a creepy thing to say.
It welcomed tens of thousands of visitors during its second run, but that would be a short-lived run. It would only last for 3 years. Unfortunately, just the high insurance rates alone forced the White family to have to close their doors.
Mm.
There weren't any additional deaths or anything reported at this time while they were open in the 80s.
Okay. So far, three children.
So three children we know have died, and the Clay family was massacred there.
Right.
So they closed down the amusement park, but they still had this land, and they were like, we need to use this land for something because it's 800 acres. And so they were pivoting to other activities to keep the land active. So they were hosting fishing tournaments in what used to be the old swimming lake. And they were planning to create a space on the property for a sport called mud bogging. And they were building a track. And this is when they made a surprising discovery that just added even another layer to what's going on at this property. So they brought in archaeologists from Marshall University, and they spent several years uncovering artifacts and graves and a total of 13 Native American skeletons. In the 1700s, the property was the active home base for the Shawnee tribe until they just suddenly disappeared. Among the bracelets, clothing, and tools that extractors found, they also found mass graves that suggested as many as 3,000 Shawnee may have been buried on the property at one point. Perhaps they were all settled there and then some kind of sickness came through.
Because it was mostly a weather elderly event or something.
Well, it was mostly elderly and children that they found. Oh. So they wonder if like some kind of big plague came about that killed the old and the young, and then they buried them all and got out. And that's why they weren't living there when we came along and said, yeah, we'll take that.
And that's why they want you to leave, because that's where all their dead are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. This gives more reason to why the Shawnee tribe was not happy and would have attacked the Clay family when they moved there. Not that that makes it right. They obviously couldn't move forward at this point with their mud bogging.
No. Sorry, that's track. Not a reason.
The White family, so Gaylord owned this, and they had been living on the property and taking care of it. They began experiencing things in their house, and when they would go to walk through the amusement park, they would notice just a feeling.
Yeah.
There were stories from some of the guests that had been there in the 80s started coming out and saying that they had felt the same thing. And they realized that once they uncovered this mass grave, there was an interest from the paranormal community. Mm. And so Gaylord White and his son, Chris, would start opening up the land for people to come and do paranormal investigations. Archaeologists could come there. So it became more of this like attraction for people to explore.
Right.
With that and more people coming there for that purpose, many visitors began to report stories when they would come there. And when the paranormal investigators would show up, they would, you know, capture things on their EVP machines. And so some of the stories over the years is that people report interactions with a little girl. There is one particular swing that will move on its own. And they say that when people come there who have never visited, they don't have it marked specifically. Everyone can always pick out what swing it is. And it's always the same one.
Yeah. Okay.
So people believe that the little girl who died is still present there.
So this is interesting, because with the Clay family, two boys, one girl died. Mm-hmm. When they reopen it, two boys, one girl died.
Oh, I didn't.
So maybe
think about
that's
that.
That's the payment. You come back on our land, we take two boys and one girl.
Maybe. I didn't think about that.
And they were children, all of them. So
they were. I was reading about children who had visited, like older people now saying, oh yeah, when I went there was always something creepy about the pond specifically where that one little boy drowned, and they don't know why. He was a good swimmer and he just went under. And there were tales of people saying, like, when they were swimming in the lake, they felt things like pulling
them.
At them.
Mm-hmm.
Even the little boy who got stuck in the drain pipe in the swimming pool, there's some thought about that. Is there something
pulling them down?
mm-hmm. and specifically children.
Yeah.
The boy who died in the lake is reported to move throughout the park. That's the other child that many believe they see. They said he prefers the area of the front of the park where he can welcome and protect visitors in a way that he was not protected when he was alive. So they feel like he's there to warn people.
Or he's just trying to leave and he keeps ending up at the same spot.
Yeah, he could be in a loop.
Yeah.
There's also an old ticket booth that is said to have a lot of activity. There was one story of a woman who was there on like one of the tours. She went into the ticket booth and closed the door behind her. She was trying to get a picture taken. And then when she tried to get back out, the door would not open, even though there was no lock on it. So okay. She felt like there was a force trying to hold her in the ticket booth.
Mm-hmm.
There is a pinwheel attached to that ticket booth that people believe is a way that the little boy from the lake communicates. They say the pinwheel moves even when there is no wind. There is a ribbon that is tied to one of the swings that is also reportedly moves with no wind. And then there's an owl ornament that somebody hung on one of the swings, because people come there and leave an offering for the little children. Supposedly those move as well.
Okay.
When there's no reason for them to be. The other big thing that is reported here is the sound of children laughing, the sound of running.
Mm-hmm.
The good thing here is it doesn't sound like any of these spirits are evil.
No, it's
children.
It was a lot of laughter and everything was exciting when this happened, but then the deaths were there. So it's like this energy stuck in time. Mm-hmm. Almost that they're experiencing.
And if there were a lot of children buried in the graves from the Native Americans, you could have little children from that time as well running around.
Maybe they're playing together.
Mm-hmm. As I said, visitors are encouraged to leave an offering as a sign of respect, both to the Shawnee people who died there and then also for the children. The White family still owns the property today. And Chris White, who is the son of Gaylord, actually will do tours for people and will walk through and show them. He lives on the land still to this day. Okay. And I think I read somewhere that his mother-in-law maybe still lives there. So people aren't afraid to be at Lake Shawnee Amusement Park.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the stories are about playful ghosts and they seem to be interested in connecting with us as humans. So if you do want to visit Lake Shawnee Amusement Park, it is open. There are three primary ways to visit. You can take a daytime tour, a nighttime experience, or during the Halloween season, you can make a trip to the Dark Carnival.
Oh.
If you go on the daytime tour, it's a guided opportunity to learn about the history and you have independent exploration so you can walk around and see if you experience anything on your own.
Mm-hmm.
If you want a ghost encounter, you can go on the overnight experience and the guests actually have a chance to sleep in the park.
No, thanks.
No, I'm good.
No, I'm just thinking about bugs. No, thanks.
I know. Where are you sleeping?
Yeah.
There's not, I guess there's old cabins.
Oh, that's true. Mm-hmm. That's true.
Now, the Dark Carnival draws thousands of visitors every year, and they have all kinds of activities ranging from fortune telling to a haunted house that may truly be haunted by these child spirits. And you can go there during that time if you want to check it out. That's the Lake Shawnee Amusement Park. Has a really dark history,
yeah.
But doesn't seem to have a really dark energy there.
Well, that's good.
So I don't know
maybe
what to make
over
of it.
Time it settled out. But yeah, that's more to me what the history was. Maybe the history needed to be known before things would stop.
Maybe there would have been continuing deaths if they had not uncovered the Shawnee graves. Maybe that released some energy too.
I'd like to say that that's what happens, but then we also shouldn't be disturbing people just because we feel like it's cool. So it's one of those things that I think is controversial, but maybe that's what happened. Energy was released or they finally got to fly away. I don't know. I would say that maybe for a while we didn't have the truth. Like you mm-hmm. said, with that marker, it's just showing that the Clays were murdered, but it's not explaining what happened and what led that to happen. So yeah. Maybe with the truth coming out, there's no longer the curse of death there. And
true.
Now it can just exist.
But you still have the little children that are trapped there who
yep.
died. Unfortunate like, circumstances.
Very unfortunate.
I can't imagine.
No. As a mother, if something happened to my child during a fun excursion, I would blame myself forever. I wouldn't even
yeah.
know how to exist anymore. That's
yeah,
so scary. Just because you wanted to have fun and you lose your kid that way. Ugh.
Like I said, every amusement park has some kind of deaths involved.
I know.
Even Disney.
Yeah, tons.
Well, thank you for the recommendation to the listener who sent it. Yeah, I don't really know what more to say about it. I don't know.
There's
not a lot. That's why I couldn't do a whole episode on it. This is the most I could find.
Yeah. And it was good.
There's probably some hauntings there for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I believe so.
I'm glad they're happy ghosts. I like happy ghosts. Maybe I would go here if I ever end up back in West Virginia.
Yeah.
The Dark Carnival sounds kind of cool.
The only thing that would intrigue me to go is if they are happy ghosts and the kids like to interact with you, maybe mm-hmm. they need that. Otherwise, I would just leave it alone.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, that was a good one.
Yeah.
All right. So now I am on to the next lab report.
Yes. More stories.
And the title of this one is called Kidnapped by My Doomsday Uncle.
Oh, no. Conspiracy theory?
That's how I would take it.
Uh-oh.
Okay. For as long as I can remember, my uncle was a doomsday guy. He was a prepper. Conspiracy was his vice. It was all he talked about, all he thought about. Growing up, I loved him. I found him to be so interesting, always talking about stuff I've never heard anyone else talk about. I credit a lot of my creativity to the stories he used to tell me. He opened my mind to a lot of things, especially the injustices of this world, and pretty early on. But I also credit him with destroying my childhood.
Making them afraid.
Yeah. I grew up way too fast, and I look back and wonder what my life would have been like if he wasn't like that. Why should I care about birthday parties or Girl Scouts if the world was going to end the next day? Looking back, it was so much for my little brain to handle, and I wish now that I wasn't so vulnerable and easily influenced.
Yeah.
His obsession built up over the years until he had no one left on his side. He is no longer with us, but I want to tell his story because a lot of what he used to say is relevant today. Also because it involves something crazy that happened to me, something that changed my life forever. And I think there is also a lesson here. The culmination of his life, the result, and what I think is important now. I do not remember much before the age of 3 or so, but I remember my uncle always being around. He was at our house almost every other day. He lived only a few houses down the street, so it made sense. It was like having 3 parents for a while. Up until I was 8 or 9 years old, it was this way. Our home was his home. He was my father's brother. My mom didn't seem to mind him being there all the time. They all got along. I remember going to sleep and they would all be around the dining room table playing cards or just talking over some beers. Sometimes I would get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and they would still be talking. That is something he was very good at, talking. He could go on for hours. As a kid, I was fascinated with his stories because he seemed like he knew everything about everything.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, he did, but it was ultimately to his detriment. He would tell me about the history of other countries, war, corruption, money, etc. Things that school wasn't teaching me. It is because of him that I knew not to trust the history they tried to teach me in school. So well, many lies, so thing. Many cover-ups. Yeah, it's good. It's good to know the right history.
Or good to know to critically think.
And then go look for it.
But yeah. You also have to not get sucked in to, because there's a lot of things on the other side too.
Yes, there is. But we also talked about space, aliens, and spiritual stuff. And as fun as those conversations were, he was always so serious about everything.
Mm.
For a few years, some of the conversations he was having with my parents were topics they didn't want to entertain, so it was causing tension. They started to fight, and often my uncle would leave abruptly with my parents huffing and puffing in another room, talking about how they needed to start limiting their time with him.
Mm-hmm.
Being so young, I never knew what the arguments were about and why everyone got so heated, but now I know it was just my parents slowly being worn down by him. My parents have always been positive, optimistic people, and my uncle was the opposite. Every day I would hear about a new way the world was going to end. It was depressing for my parents.
I know people like this.
I definitely know people like this.
Like, I remember 2012 was a big deal. The Mayan calendar, and that was supposed to be the end of the world.
That's
and,
almost like too big of stuff. That's like taking one big thing. But it's the people who think next Monday it's ending because of this and this and we have to run away.
I mean, whole cults are built around this. I know. I can see how people get sucked into it. But at some point, you got to realize that
you got to live.
The world can end at any moment.
Seriously. Your life can end right now.
My world can end at any moment.
Yes.
You should live every day like it could be your last. Yeah. But sitting around in like fear of it all like the time is not helping anyone.
No, it's not. It was depressing for my parents, especially when trying to raise happy kids and shelter them from life's cruelties. As an adult now, I understand them. As a child, I would get angry with them and blame them for fighting with my uncle because that would mean he wouldn't come around for a few days. He was my entertainment. He was my mentor. And what I didn't know then is that he was just taking things too far.
Yeah.
I understand that all around the world, people are living in different circumstances, and talks like the ones he used to have with me are necessary and based on everyday issues that other people experience. But for me at that time, the threat to my life was not so, and because of our talks and his obsession, I was lost. With how often he was over, I'm pretty sure he didn't have any friends other than my parents.
Aww.
When he went too far and something would end in a fight, he'd finally come back a few days later. He wouldn't talk about certain things and would just chill out and enjoy his time with us instead of talking our ears off. I could tell that is when my parents would enjoy having him around and would even let him sleep on the couch. But this never lasted long until he would bring something up again that made my parents not want him to be there. A couple weeks before my 10th birthday, my uncle lost his house. He wasn't good at keeping jobs. Sometimes he would be really focused on work, and other times he just didn't care and things would get bad for him. One of those times he didn't pay his rent for a few months and they evicted him.
Mm-mm.
With nowhere to go, of course, he ended up staying with us. I remember my dad talking to him one morning on the front porch. My uncle had his head down, and I could tell that the conversation was serious. My room was at the front of the house, so I went in there and I cracked my window a little bit to hear what they were saying. My dad was telling him that if he was going to live with us, that he needed to calm down with the conspiracy talk, especially around us kids. He agreed, but if you know someone like my uncle, it is impossible for them. What I haven't mentioned is that I do have two other siblings, a younger brother, he was only two at the time, and an older brother. He's 3 years older than me. I was the only girl. My older brother didn't care much for my uncle and mostly stayed in his room whenever he was there. Now, I know that is because he was already over him too. My little brother, he was just too young to know anything. Still busy trying to figure out how to eat food properly. I swear my daughter is still trying to figure that out.
I'm still trying to figure that out sometimes when I drop it all over me.
So that left me. When my parents didn't want to talk to him, he would turn to me and tell me everything going on in the world. And sometimes I was the only one he could talk to. So I became the most important person in his world.
That's not good for an adult man.
Yeah. Oh, she addresses this.
Oh, okay.
There was never anything inappropriate with my uncle, just in case your brains are going good, there. Good.
I mean, we can't help but our brains go there. Yep. We've seen too much.
I think that is important to mention, considering the sick world we live in. But my uncle was just extremely overprotective of me, more than my parents at times. At least it felt like that for a while. It wasn't until I was a teenager that I realized that isn't what it was about. They just wanted me to be a kid, and my uncle was too intense. With him in the house, it was stressful. Even I could tell. But one week, it was really bad. He was fighting with my parents constantly, and he wasn't sleeping. One night, I came out, and he was rocking back and forth, sitting on the couch.
Uh-oh.
The next morning, I woke up to my dad yelling at him to leave. And he did. And it was this day that my life changed.
Okay.
I went to school with my brother. We walked. We went to a K-12 school. It was nice having my brother walk with me because even at 9, with all the warnings my uncle put into my head, I was very aware and all about stranger danger.
I'm sure. Paranoid, probably.
Yeah. It was after lunch that I was called to the office. My uncle was there to pick me up. I was so excited. I had never been taken out of school or picked up early unless I was sick, and he was going to take me to the arcade.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. This is scary. This shit can happen.
Like my worst nightmare as a parent. My kids are older now, but God, when they were younger, I was always worried about
someone coming and taking them.
Yeah. And if they're a legal guardian.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, I don't know when this happened, but you know, when we were kids, anybody probably could have taken us home.
Right. That's true.
My mom's friend could have been like, oh, I need to take Kendra home. Her mom was in an accident. And they would have been like, okay. At least now there's forms you fill out, like who can take your kid out.
He said, my dad thought it would be fun for us to do something after we heard them fight.
Okay.
For a moment, I thought about my brother and why he wasn't coming. But like I said, my brother didn't really like my uncle, so it made sense. We got in the car and started driving. It was after an hour or so that I realized we were not going to the arcade. I asked him where we were going, and he was weirdly responsive. His eyes were wide and he was mumbling. At the time, I didn't understand that he was having some sort of episode. But he was talking about how we were going to the mountains and that we had to get away because something really bad was about to happen and he needed to protect me.
Oh.
He went on and on about how my parents didn't understand and that only he could take care of me. He promised that he would take me back to them in a few days, but that we had to be away from the city for a little while.
Okay. This is so scary.
I know.
This poor little girl.
We stayed at motels along the way. Camped twice. He stopped at a Kmart to buy me some clothes, books, and food. At first, it felt like a fun vacation. We stopped at a putt-putt in a small town. We went bowling. We went to a movie. I saw Jungle to Jungle, which I still remember vividly. Jungle to Jungle.
I don't know that one.
I do know that movie. It's a Tim Allen movie. I don't know if that's the right one, but is it? Oh, you haven't seen it, so you can't help me. We were the only ones in the theater, and it was in the middle of the day on a school day. I felt like the coolest kid ever.
Kid mentality right there.
We went on hikes and sat by a lake one day eating snacks and watching the birds. With all the fun we were having, after each time, he made sure to say something like, "Soak it up. We may never get to do this again." Or he'd say something like, "We shouldn't be doing this. This was stupid. We're wasting time." All I know is that we kept driving and driving. I tried to pay attention to road signs, but I didn't recognize any of the names. I had no concept of time, but after a while, I was really missing my mom and asked him if I could call her. He kept coming up with excuses and would just say that he was taking me home soon. That was the only time he would be stern with me, and I could tell that it was stressing him out. After a few days of asking too many times and seeing his reaction, I stopped.
Mm-mm.
It wasn't until then that I was really starting to worry. I felt like we had been gone too long. My little brain started putting things together. There was no way my parents would agree to me going on a trip with my uncle.
Right.
I remembered the fight that they had that morning when my dad made him leave. My uncle told me going with him was my dad's idea, but after mulling it over, I realized that most of my dad's arguments were specifically about how he didn't like how my uncle was around us, the kids. I loved my uncle, but I started to worry that maybe my uncle wasn't okay. It was then I couldn't stop thinking about my family. I made the decision that I needed to find a way to call my mom, with or without his help.
Poor thing.
It's like, scary.
I'm like just sitting here imagining how you would handle that as a 9-year-old.
I know. It just, we got to prepare our kids.
Mm-hmm.
It sucks to say, hey, let's figure out a plan if you're abducted, but this is what we need to try and do.
Yeah.
Aye, aye, aye. We were staying at a motel one night and I tried calling when he was in the shower, but I couldn't figure out how to call out. I finally focused, read the instructions and called. It started to ring, but he was coming out of the bathroom and I hung up. The next morning, we had breakfast at that same motel. I was given crayons with my kids' menu. I was sitting there stabbing at my pancakes when I came up with a plan. I stuffed a napkin and crayon into my pocket and told him that I needed to use the restroom.
Write a note.
I went to the bathroom and wrote my parents' phone number on the napkin with a little explanation to call them and tell them where I am. When I came out of the bathroom, the waitress was walking by and I stopped her. He couldn't see me from where he was. I handed it to her. I told her he wasn't a bad man. He is my uncle and I'm fine, but I miss my mom.
Oh, can you imagine being that server that has a little girl say
that to
you?
Oh, I know. And to handle it quietly.
I'd be calling the cops right away if I was her.
She did, I'm sure. I went and sat back down and continued to eat my breakfast. He was busy reading the newspaper and drinking coffee. About 20-30 minutes later, cops showed up and approached us. The entire thing was so horrible. My uncle was crying and screaming. I was crying. I didn't want him to be in trouble, but I wanted my parents. He was arrested and I was taken back to the police station where they called my parents. What I didn't know was that my parents and lots of people had been looking for me for almost 2 weeks.
Wow.
Having my own kids now, I can't imagine the horror that they went through.
No.
I didn't know it had been that long, but when I found out, I remember thinking that it felt like I was gone longer than that. It was a wild adventure, but I just wanted my bed and I wanted to cuddle my cat and hear my little brother's giggles.
Right.
I was reunited with my family and my uncle went to jail for 6 months. We visited him. My parents forgave him over time, but time with him was limited to scheduled family visits.
Mm-hmm.
I loved him very much still, and he was never mad at me for having to go to jail, but I spent the next decade of my life feeling guilty for it because as I grew up, I just realized he was not well.
Mentally off somehow.
Mm-hmm. When you can't pull yourself out of that.
Yeah.
It becomes a mental issue.
It's like psychosis.
Yeah,
like
right.
They just spiral and spiral.
Mm-hmm. But eventually he got his wish and moved to a small mountain town and lived out his dream.
Well, good.
Away from everything and living as simple as possible. He was there until his death 8 years ago. He died from cancer. He never received treatment. He didn't believe in our medical system. Neither do I, but he didn't have the resources to heal himself otherwise. Overall, as I watch the crap in this world unfold and come to light, I realize more and more every day that he was right. Everything he told me from what I can remember and the conversations with him since is all true. No longer conspiracies. Even though his specific end of days things didn't happen when he said they would, all the things that led up to it are true and are happening. And if you know, you know. But he got one thing wrong, and I am thankful to know this now. I am so incredibly thankful that I was able to recover from his way of thinking. You can't live your life in constant fear.
No.
You can't spend every waking moment thinking about all the bad stuff. You can't fear every corner you turn around. You can plan, but you can't be on the edge every second of the day. We need hope. We need love and connection. We need to live life as if shitty things aren't happening sometimes. We need family and fun. Otherwise, what's the point?
Right. Absolutely. Amen, sister.
In the end, my uncle died alone. And of all the end time events he thought would happen, none of them did. Which is amazing. Thank goodness. Hallelujah. Some people around the world aren't so lucky. But he was living in another time that wasn't for us. He spent the better part of 30 years obsessed with everything collapsing and being one of the people prepared for it. I am absolutely supportive of anyone who wants to prepare and have plans in place. I really am. Scary shit is happening and has been happening for a very long time all over the world. And I'm extra concerned about the state of our country right now. I'm sickened every day. But what I will not do is not live. If something insane is going to happen to all of us, I'm going to live until then. And I'm going to make sure that my kids enjoy life in the meantime as well.
Yep.
I have a 6-year-old and 2-year-old, and they are my life. I will tell them about things for their own safety. No rose-colored glasses. But that doesn't mean I can't make sure their lives aren't fantastic otherwise. And I will always stand by that. Be prepared, but make sure you are loving the shit out of life at the same time. Otherwise, they win. We have this one life. It is your choice how you approach each day. And even when your circumstances are dire, the smallest things can turn it around. You can find happiness if you keep your heart open. That was a lot.
That was good.
But it was all like, very true.
It's all very, very much how I feel in a lot of ways.
Yes. Well, girls, I know that wasn't the most exciting story and a bit bleak at times, but it is something crazy I went through that taught me a lot. And I hope it gives others some perspective. Love your conspiracy theory friends because they're not conspiracies, but agreeing with them doesn't mean you have to live depressing, isolated lives. If you feel like you need to act to help change things, do it. We need people like that. It is one thing to know everything, but it is another thing to do something about it. I have respect for every human being and everything we each go through, but I hope that every person finds happiness throughout their day despite the chaos, despite the horror, despite the lies. And even though it feels like 99% of humans are evil sometimes, the truth is, most of us are beautiful souls who just need to connect. It is the evil elites and egos that run the world, and someday we'll get it back. But until then, stay safe and educated while doing things that make you happy. Peace and love for all. Your lucid listener, C.
Nice. I am sitting here like, what do I say to that? I felt like I just went to
inspirational TED Talk real quick.
The way she ended it was really good. I'm like, yes, 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 all of that.
It's true.
Check, check.
Check, check, check.
Well, thank you for writing in. That was...
I'm really sorry that you had to experience that with with your uncle.
To have to live her childhood like that, that's what I would be sad for, is that she lived in more of a state of fear than you should. That's the one time in your life as a child you should not have to think about adult things, if that makes sense, because you're going to have plenty of that later in life.
Seriously.
You want your kids to just be able to be whimsical and think that their dreams can come true and all that. Not in like some crazy Disney kind of way, but like...
Right. They can't be oblivious.
Yes.
It's important to be aware. What I'd call is the American bubble. We grew up in an American bubble where they didn't tell us the truth about shit.
Yes.
And we didn't know what was going on in the rest of the world. We were the country, right?
Right. We're the best.
We're the best. Everybody's trying to get to us. When there was this massive world out there, they knew what was happening in other countries. We were so blindsided.
We were.
Now, you know, having a young kid myself, it's like I have the opportunity to educate her about the world.
Yes.
And the things going on in the world and how to be safe and this and this and that. But I'm also going to make sure that she is having a blast.
Right.
While we're doing all of this.
Exactly. Like there's otherwise, like C said, what's the point? I think that's why I always wanted to travel so much with my kids, because I wanted them to see the worldly experience.
Right.
And also to respect and be thankful for what we do have in America. It's a fine line, because you do want to talk to them about some of those things because you want them to grow up being aware.
They need to be prepared for different situations.
But you have to do it in a way that they're not afraid of their own shadow.
I know. Some of them you just got to eat it and tell them anyway, because it's something that can happen tomorrow. Yep. The end of the world happening tomorrow, those are always the thing that gets me with conspiracy stuff. You know,
like I know.
And it's only because that is a really scary place to live. If you're constantly thinking that some event is going to end everything as we know it on Tuesday, and then that didn't happen, so you choose next Friday, and then that didn't happen. Like, you're constantly living in a way that, why are you living? Like, what is the point? Like,
you are not living.
You're not living. So don't take other people down with you. You feel like you're educating people and trying to help them be prepared. Then you need to do it in a way that is not condescending. Because that's how a lot of this gets is, you're just so stupid. You don't know the truth enough.
Yeah. Yet. Even if I knew, like, I knew 100% we were going to die in 2 weeks, like the end of the world, there's no way I'm going to survive it. I would be busy spending all my money on really cool shit and trying to do everything that I possibly could to enjoy the last 2 weeks.
I don't even think it's end of the world stuff sometimes, but maybe like a specific area.
Like the electrical grid's going to go down or something.
Those are things we can experience. But if you're constantly stocking up every time someone says something, not only are you wasting money and you're putting yourself in a really bad position, because that stuff doesn't last a long time.
No.
Have enough to get you through a few days.
Right.
No one's ever going to be able to be prepared for
a year. Right. And like I said, I don't want to live through a zombie apocalypse anyway.
And the likelihood that you'd be able to stay in one place for a year, unless you are wealthy, wealthy, wealthy with the bunker and something like that, it's not likely.
Yeah, because you're going to have to go out to get supplies.
Do what you can, but don't kill yourself doing it and make sure to live. Anywho, do you have something exciting next?
let's see. Well, I'm doing another mini episode, and I can't say that it's like fun or exciting. It does have, I think, as happy of an ending as true crime can.
Okay.
So this is a case I've brought up several times, I think, to you, Jessica. I wanted to do a full episode on this, and it is the Lady of the Dunes.
Yeah, you've brought this up a few different times.
I'm going to bring back the Morbid podcast. This was one of the first ones that I listened to from those ladies because it takes place in Massachusetts. It is one of the most enduring and frustrating murder mysteries that Massachusetts had. It was an unsolved mystery for years and years and years.
So why is it the dunes? Because every time you've mentioned this, I just think of the dunes here, like the sand dunes.
It is sand dunes in Massachusetts on the beach.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Oh, on the beach. Mm-hmm. Very
sand
different.
Dunes, yes. Yeah. So while this was a huge mystery and cold case, the Lady of the Dunes was called that, kind of like the Black Dahlia, because they didn't know who she was. She was a Jane Doe.
Okay.
But hold on, because this story does have a happy ending. Because of recent advancements in forensic science, they were able to find out who she was
and
even find her killer.
Wow.
So as happy as it can get in a true crime story.
Yeah. Good to have it closed up.
So on July 26th of 1974, a little 12-year-old girl was out walking her dog along the dunes. They're called the Race Point Dunes in Provincetown, Massachusetts. And her dog started barking and she kind of lost him. He like ran off and she followed him and she came upon a really scary sight.
Ooh, a little girl found her?
Yes.
Yikes.
It was a decomposing body. The girl immediately freaked out, as you can imagine, as a 12-year-old, and she ran back and contacted authorities. The police came out and a full forensics investigation was completed, and this is what they found. The victim was lying face down on half of a beach blanket.
Mm.
She was covered in insects, so she had obviously been there for a little while.
Right.
They found two sets of footprints leading to her body, and they found tire tracks that were 50 yards from the scene.
Oh.
After analysis, they decided that she may have died about 2 weeks before her body was found.
Oh, wow. That's a long time to be out
there.
Really
long time. There was no sign of a struggle, and police theorized she either knew her killer or had been asleep when she died.
Oh, no. Sunbathing?
Yes. She was not wearing any clothing.
Oh.
But there was a blue bandana and a pair of Wrangler jeans that were placed under her head, like she had been laying on them. So they theorized maybe she was out sunbathing.
Oh, like she just stopped there, but she wasn't going to go in the water or anything.
Right. And she was tucked away so she could sunbathe naked. That was one of their original thoughts.
Okay.
She had long auburn hair pulled back into a ponytail and her toenails were painted pink.
Oh.
They determined that she was approximately 5'6" tall and she weighed around 145 pounds and she was an athletic build. They estimated that she was between 25 and 40 years old. And here's the really messed up part. They couldn't really identify her because she was missing both of her hands and one forearm.
Oh, from animals or intentionally taken?
Intentionally taken.
Oh.
She was also nearly decapitated, they believe possibly from strangulation.
Oh my gosh.
One side of her head had been crushed, possibly with some kind of tool, I guess like a wrench or something heavy.
So much going on for her just laying on the beach.
Yes. And the head injury was determined to be the cause of death. There were also signs of sexual assault on the body, likely postmortem.
Oh, because there was no signs of her fighting back. Well, we don't have her hands.
And so we're going to go through all the theories here in a minute. They believe that the missing hands and the forearm, and she was also missing teeth. They believe that whoever had killed her was trying to hide
who they were and either who
she was or who they were. Yeah. So they took away any kind of evidence of what happened. They pored over thousands and thousands of missing person cases, and they tried to track down the tire tracks, and they couldn't find anything. There was no matches. The sand and beach blanket were not disturbed, suggesting that the body was possibly moved to the specific spot where she was found.
Oh, okay.
So they don't think that the attack actually happened where she was laying.
And you didn't say anything about a shirt.
She didn't have a shirt. She okay. just had the jeans, the bandana, the blanket she was lying on, and her ponytail holder. That was the only things on the body.
Okay.
They were able to identify, even though she was missing teeth, that she had had about $5,000 to $10,000 worth of dental work done, including crowns.
Okay.
But several of her teeth have been removed. So I don't know if you can identify by crowns. I'm not real sure on how dental forensics works. But he did enough where they could not identify this body. They looked over missing persons and the case went cold. They couldn't find out who she even was. And if you don't know who the victim is, where do you even start to find who killed her?
Yeah. And this is the 70s. For someone to know the specific teeth that you would need to take to stop identification sounds like an interesting person who's doing
this. Exactly. They were able to try and reconstruct her face because it was so badly damaged from being beaten by whatever tool that you couldn't really tell.
Yeah.
And she had been decomposing for 2 weeks.
Right.
They kept trying to work this case, but there were no new clues. But it was one of those cases that like cops just couldn't let go.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Black Dahlia in a lot of ways. I think that's why I was drawn to it. So here was the original theories that came out while they were investigating and continuing to do everything that they could. There was one in 1987, a Canadian woman told a friend that she saw her father strangle a woman in Massachusetts around 1972.
Oh.
Police attempted to locate the woman but were unsuccessful. Another woman told the police when she saw the picture of the reconstruction of the victim that it looked like her sister, and she said her sister had gone missing in Boston in 1974.
Okay.
There was a lead out there that involved a missing criminal, Rory Jean Kessinger, who would have been 25 years old at the time of the murder. She had broken out of jail in 1973 and people saw a resemblance between Kessinger and the victim.
Interesting.
They were able to do a DNA, not with Kessinger, obviously, because she'd been missing, but they traced it back to Kessinger's mother and it didn't match the victim. So they were able to rule out that it was not the escaped jail victim.
She is in Costa Rica.
She's gone. I don't know where she's at. There were two other missing women, Frances Ewalt of Montana and Vicki Lamerton of Massachusetts, that were brought up as possible people that this woman could be, but they were also ruled out. So they had no leads still. There was a theory that came out in August of 2015 that the Lady of the Dunes may have been an extra in the 1975 film Jaws.
Okay.
It had been shot on Martha's Vineyard, about 100 miles south of Provincetown between May and October of 1974. Here was what happened. So Joe Hill, he was the son of Stephen King, actually, and he brought it to the police attention while watching the movie Jaws.
Oh, okay.
In the 4th of July beach scene, there is a woman in the crowd wearing a blue bandana and jeans, which are very similar to what was found with the body.
Interesting.
The lead investigator on the case at the time did note it as interesting, but he thought it was far-fetched and wild speculation. But this was one of those things that kind of like went viral as things could go in 2015. I don't think we had as much social media, but everybody,
right.
Lady of the Dunes was suspected to be this woman and people were watching the movie Jaws and trying to like zoom in and find out who she could be.
Yeah.
And so they thought she came there, she was in the movie, and then she met this unfortunate end.
Well, can't they just get a list of names, or do they let anybody walk on off the street and not know who they are as far as extras go in the movies?
I mean, it was 1970s. It was probably like, hey, anybody want to come stand in the beach crowd? We're going to film a movie. So that would be my guess. They didn't have to sign their little copyright things back in the day.
Okay.
So that was probably one of the more interesting theories. There was another theory in 1981. There was a woman who resembled the victim that was seen with the mobster Whitey Bulger around the time the woman presumably died.
Okay.
And Whitey Bulger was known for removing his victim's teeth.
Okay.
There was never any substantial lead to link this Lady of the Dunes to Bulger. And he was murdered in prison in 2018. So that kind of went cold. Hmm.
It was initially thought that she could have been a victim of the serial killer Tony Costa, who was active in the area. But they were able to rule that out because Costa died on May 12, 1974, and her body was found in July of 1974.
Okay.
In 2004, they thought they had solved this case when a man named Haddon Clark came forward. He was already a convicted murderer, and he confessed to the murder, stating, "I could have told the police what her name was, but after they beat the shit out of me, I wasn't going to tell them shit." And he said, "This murder is still unsolved, and what the police are looking for is in my grandfather's garden."
Oh.
Then they found out that Clark suffered from paranoid schizophrenia, and they know that that is a condition that may lead to someone confessing falsely. They did follow up on this lead, and they found nothing in his grandfather's garden.
And his grandfather's like, "Thanks. Now can you hire a landscaper to put it back together?"
He's like, "What am I going to do now with my zucchini plants?" So that was the last big lead that happened. That was around 2004, and it went cold again. But the Massachusetts police never gave up, and I'm glad they didn't.
Yeah.
In 2022, they sent the skeletal remains. They have dug up this body multiple times, so I kind of feel bad. But also, at the same time, they need to find out who she is. They still don't know who she is.
Right.
And they sent her to Othram, which I don't know if you've heard of them. I had to look up who they are. So they're a company that specializes in forensic genetic genealogy to resolve unsolved murders, disappearances, and identification of descendants of murder victims. So okay. They can do all the DNA profiling that is needed. And that was successful for them. The DNA profile was generated that was used to identify distant relatives of the skeletal remains. And eventually they were able to identify the victim.
That's
this
good.
Just happened.
Wow. And
October 31st of 2022, they were able to announce that the victim had been identified as Ruth Marie Terry. So now that the Lady of the Dunes identity was known, police began putting together the story of her life and retracing possible reasons she was in Massachusetts and who might have been with her. So Ruth Marie Terry was born on September 8th, 1936 in a mountainside shack in Whitewall, Tennessee. In 1957, following a short-lived marriage, Ruth left Whitewall to work at the Fisher Body Automotive Plant in Livonia, Michigan.
Okay.
She gave birth to a son, but was unable to care for him due to financial difficulties. She adopted her son out to the superintendent of her workplace.
Interesting.
In return for him paying off all of her debts and expenses. After she adopted her child out, she left Livonia, Michigan and moved to California.
It was a transaction. You get my kid and you pay off all my... I have no more debt.
Yes.
Okay.
So, doesn't sound like she had a great life.
Yeah.
It does say that she reached out to her son in 1972, but he was not ready to meet her.
Oh, that sucks.
So not good. On February 16th of 1974, she married a man named Guy Rockwell Moldavin. He was an antiques dealer in Reno, Nevada. 4 months before her death, the couple visited her family back in Tennessee, and her niece at the time named Brittany said that Ruth didn't seem to be herself whenever she was around Guy Moldavin, and that he exhibited very possessive behavior towards her.
Great.
The couple then went to Chattanooga to visit Ruth's half-brother Kenneth and his wife Carol. They were able to tell the cops that they recalled that they were going to head to Massachusetts for some antique shopping because that was what he did.
Right.
So they were able to piece it all together and figure out that in the late summer of 1974, they were in Massachusetts. And then Guy returned to their home in California without her after this massive road trip. They'd only been married for 6 months. And, you know, her niece was already saying that he was exhibiting possessive behavior. So yeah, there were some red flags here.
Right.
So he came back without her. And then he made a trip to Tennessee to visit Ruth's family. And he told them that she had just gone missing one day from their California home.
Why would he go visit her family?
Yeah, it seems odd. Like, they don't really know each other that well.
Yeah.
They said he stayed for a short time and that he was acting really odd. Ruth's brother began suspecting something happened, and he actually hired a private investigator to try and find her.
Oh, you didn't look in Massachusetts.
He told Ruth's family that all of her belongings had been sold and that she had left the state of her own will after becoming involved with a religious cult.
That's what the investigator said?
This is why she wasn't ever listed as a missing person.
And that's what people did back then, so...
And they were like, oh, yep, she ran off to a religious cult. And, you know, you've got the new husband of 6 months saying, yeah, she just left. And then the private investigator that they hire comes back and says, yeah, she joined a religious cult. I don't know if her husband was able to orchestrate that looking that way or what he did, but
she left a note.
The family was just like, yep, sounds like something she would do, and never looked for her again.
Sounds like something she would do.
In the 2 decades prior to her identification, the family of Ruth just decided that she was probably deceased.
Okay, so we've done cult stuff. Families who love their family attempt to communicate and go look and try and get them to come back.
So after some investigation and hearing this information from the family of Ruth, they decided they needed to look into this guy, Moldavin, that she married just 6 months prior to her coming up dead in Massachusetts.
Oh, he thought he got away with it.
So on November 2nd, just 3 days after they identified Ruth's body, they announced that they were seeking information on Ruth's husband, Guy. Unfortunately, he had died in 2002.
Oh.
They were able to find out that Guy was an orphan. He was adopted by a family, and not much more was known about his upbringing. They do know in 1942, he was living in New York City, and he had attended the American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Oh.
He was working as a professor in 1946, so he was actually an educated man.
Oh, wow.
And he was married. They lived in New York City for a while, and then Seattle. He began working as a DJ. The couple divorced in 1956. 2 years later, he married another woman in Idaho. He just sounds like a guy who was like bouncing all over the place. Yeah. He had a few kids with women, but then things kind of went downhill for him. He, in 1960, was charged with larceny because he swindled his third wife's family out of $10,000.
Oh, geez.
And then they also discovered that that second wife of his, she also went missing.
Oh, interesting.
In 1961, because of this $10,000 larceny charge, he was convicted of those charges and sentenced to 15 years in prison, but the judge suspended the sentence just 1 year later, as long as Guy would repay the $10,000 to the family. So he should have gone to prison. He didn't. This is another story. He's got a second wife who's missing that they're not looking into at the time.
She's most in a likely. Cult.
Probably. Maybe that was his whole shtick. Spiel. It sounds like he was kind of a con artist
type of a dude. Sounds like.
He was also seen as a prime suspect in the disappearance of Barbara Jo Kelly, who was a 17-year-old waitress that went missing in June of 1950.
Why is this sounding like Fred's little brother?
Right. She was last seen in California on June 17th when she left on a date with Henry Baird, her boyfriend. Baird's body was discovered face down on the beach near Table Bluff the following morning. He had received a gunshot to the back of his head.
Face down on a beach.
Yes. And then Barbara's personal clothing was found carefully folded and tucked underneath his, with the exception of her shoes and pantyhose. But no trace of Barbara herself was ever found. She has not been seen or heard from since that night. And it was always thought that whoever had shot Henry, her boyfriend, had probably kidnapped her.
Obviously, they have her clothing.
But they never connected this until they found Ruth to be the Lady of the Dunes. So this guy, Moldavin guy, was just running around killing people.
Yeah.
Who else did he kill? Those are just the ones they found.
Right. And it sounds like he was all over the fucking place.
He was. He traveled all over the world.
He could have victims everywhere. That's rough. His name is Guy.
He's that guy.
Guy.
According to his obituary, he died in his home in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Ah!
After a lengthy illness. It always ends up back in New Mexico or Texas.
What the heck?
He had worked as an antiques dealer for years, and we don't know. He may have killed many other women.
Oh, in Santa Fe? We have such a problem with girls going missing in New Mexico. I know it's everywhere, but it's all over the place in New Mexico.
I don't know. He had been married again. At the end of his life, I think he had been married about 5 or 6 times, including the 2 wives that we know went missing, which was Ruth and then his second
that's
wife.
That's so scary.
And this is a guy who would have never like come up on a radar. He that's wasn't a sex offender.
Exactly. People are just dealing with him every day and have no idea his history.
This reminds me of another story I read recently where the guy had killed like 3 or 4 people and they were just so random that it would never have been connected.
Yeah.
And he was just living his life as like an insurance salesman or something. It makes me worried that how many people are we living next to right now who have these dark histories?
Too many.
And this guy named Guy was part of the problem because he was a possessive man.
We heard that from Ruth's niece saying that he was acting very jealous. He's the type of guy that if you're his wife or girlfriend and you look any other way, he assumes that you're going to cheat on him. Very insecure kind of person.
It makes me worry about his time as a professor.
He lived in New York, Seattle, California.
Yeah.
He's been all over.
Scary.
Anyways, he was officially named as Ruth Terry's killer on August 28th of 2023. And this case officially moved from being an unidentified homicide victim, mystery lady of the dunes, to being the murder of Ruth Terry by her husband, Guy Moldavin.
Who is now a serial killer.
He was definitely a serial killer.
Yeah.
And we don't know how many victims were connected to this man.
Oh my gosh. Anybody who listens from New Mexico, know this guy? Do you know this guy?
Yeah.
I'm curious. I'm just curious if down there it was on the news once it was figured out.
He died in 2002. So that was a long time ago.
His 2023, victims, yeah. This was officially named. That was last year. I'm just curious if it showed up on the news down there or if they said anything at all.
I don't know. I'm hoping that they're still looking into this guy. They've connected him to these three
mm-hmm.
murders. He's not connected to his second wife, but they haven't found her body. So yeah, they can't connect him. Hard. She's just missing. But I'm assuming she is dead somewhere and he did something to her.
They definitely need to be looking into his DNA and seeing if it pops up anywhere else.
We have better forensics than we ever have.
Yes.
This was a case that had been open since 1974 and we solved it.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this forensic evidence, this gives me hope. That's why I say it's a happy ending that we can find others that are out there, these victims. Ruth, who had just been Jane Doe, Lady of the Dunes, mm-hmm. almost 50 years later, finally got justice.
Crazy.
In the best way that you can. Unfortunately, they can't do anything to Guy. And what's fucked up about this story is that Guy got to just live his life.
He got to live for almost another 30 years.
It did say that he died from some long illness. I hope it was very, very painful.
Boils.
All over every part of his body.
And they were just constantly popping.
Anyways, fuck you, Guy Moldavin, for killing however many women that you have, but especially mm-hmm. for Ruth
and not just
Terry.
Women. He killed the man too.
Because he wanted that woman, probably. Mm-hmm. That makes me think that he's done more.
If he was willing to kill a boyfriend. Yeah, if he's willing to kill men, that shows you that he wasn't scared of shit and his confidence was a little too high. He had an ego. He's even more dangerous.
So that is the Lady of the Dunes. It is no longer a mystery. She was not an extra in the Jaws movie. She was just a woman who, like so many of us, made an unfortunate choice in the man that she fell in love with.
For all we know, it was his traveling that at first intrigued her.
Here's my other thing before I end this. He chopped off her hands and pulled her teeth. This is a guy who's done stuff before.
Absolutely.
And knew what to do to cover his tracks.
I think the first place to start is who's missing hands.
Yeah. R.I.P. Ruth Terry. I'm glad we were able to identify you and your family now knows what happened, as unfortunate as it is, but at least now they don't think that you just ran away in some religious cult.
And they also should have gone to look for you, my opinion. Yeah.
It sounds like she had a pretty interesting life to begin with. She was traveling all over. She gave her son up for adoption. So I don't know.
I get it.
Much about.
But at the same time, just don't ever assume. This is kind of what we've come back to. Like, you can't assume and then just let it go.
Right. You have to look right away. You have to
maybe in looking right away, obviously you're not going to save their life, but it could have stopped Fred and Rose much sooner if it was found out somehow, some way. Anyway, that's a crazy story.
Well, that is our final mini episode for this Lab Reports.
Well, this one seemed more like a Lab Reports of lessons.
It kind of is.
Every decision matters.
Yes.
Be respectful of land.
Don't take what's not yours.
Live your life. Be prepared and plan, but live your life. And if someone goes missing, don't assume they ran away.
No, never. And especially not if their husband comes and says, yeah, she's just gone.
Yeah,
maybe look into that guy a little bit more.
Exactly.
I wonder, maybe he was just like a con artist type of smooth talker.
Of course, they all are. That's what serial killers are.
Mm-hmm. They've learned. Yeah, I think I like how you said that this was a lessons episode. So we have brought you words of wisdom today. That's what we do on Lucid Lab.
All righty, guys. Well, be sure to come back next week. Please send in your lab reports and your suggestions to lucidlabpodcast@gmail.com.
And you can find us on all the social media. We're on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. And we will post some pictures from the mini episodes today.
And that's all.
And that's it.
Go have fun.
Enjoy the spring weather.
Live, laugh, love, eat,
drink.
Stay lucid.
Always. Bye, guys.
Adios.